Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, we meet the host of a program new to KPBX, but familiar to KSFC listeners. Her name, Sarah Aronson. Her program, The Right Question, which now follows Northwest Arts Review each Thursday afternoon on KPBX. Also, Spokane Symphony music director James Lowe reports from his home in Edinburgh, Scotland, updating us on his hopes and trepidations as the symphony plans its next steps. And Dan Webster will be by with a film review. Our music going in is courtesy of Ludwig van Beethoven by way of the Spokane String Quartet. This is Northwest Arts Review. KPBX listeners will likely have noticed that there's now a new voice and a new program at 12:30 each Thursday. The program is The Right Question from Montana Public Radio, a half hour dedicated to conversation with writers from and literature about the American West. The voice is that of host Sarah Aronson, herself an award-winning and widely published poet. Here is our conversation. A delight to be introducing you to our listeners.
Well, thank you for the generous invitation and for joining our programs together, Jim. It's nice to talk to you over the mountains.
How about that? Yes. And let's see now. Maybe it would be good to start with, here you are. Your background is in literature.
I am a therapist by trade, Jim, which gives me some interviewing skills. But, you know, I came into this position while I was finishing my last year as an MFA student in the University of Montana Creative Writing Program with an emphasis in poetry. So I have the literary credential of being a poet, which I don't know what kind of weight that carries.
Oh, we're big on poetry around here. We have a regular daily feature on KPBX, which is the Poetry Moment. And
that's right. And I have actually met Chris Messini at our book festival years ago, and we are now carrying the Poetry Moment on Montana Public
Radio.
That's
right. I've forgotten about that. So, you know, one of these days you may be appearing on the I'm sure that Chris will be trying to prevail upon you to be one of the voices. And that'd be really, really kind of cool. So with that understood, that really interesting background that brings together aspects of therapy, aspects of poetry, and how did this morph into a radio show, for heaven's sake?
Right. So it began in 2007 by Cherie Newman, and it originally was a 14-minute program. And the idea, as I understand it, was that it's pretty clear that Montana has a wealth of literary talent, you know, going back decades. And we also are home to one of the more famous writing programs in the country, the Creative Writing Program at the University of Montana, which was founded by Richard Hugo. And so it seemed like we were sitting on top of a treasure chest. And the notion of having a radio program and podcast just made a lot of sense. And she carried it for 10 years. And then I took over 3 years ago in 2017 and have tried to carry on the mission, which is to feature, you know, some of the literary heavyweights of Montana and of the West. And more recently, Jim, I would say I've tried to make a program that's more inclusive and is trying to be more aware of the new voices of the West. You know, that Ivan Doig is amazing, you know, Thomas McGuane, Norman McLean, James Lee Burke. We love those voices. And also there are so many more that can contribute to the conversation about how we identify as Westerners.
From your experience with this, is there something recognizable or something that is a salient characteristic of the writing that comes from the West?
Right. So I'll lay claim to my my place of residence. You know, I was born and raised in Southeast Alaska, and I've lived in the West. I've lived in Washington State. I've lived in Arizona, Idaho, and Montana for you know, 40 years. And so I have an identification with this place. And I think a lot of people would say that the landscape is a huge character in much writing, you know, and there is some recent, maybe not criticism, but interrogation of that. You know, what does it mean to sort of sentimentalize the land in the way that we do, knowing that this land has also been stolen land. It's also been extracted land. It's also been, you know, harmed in numerous kinds of ways. So that's one of the key things that I identify with Western writers. And I also think that, you know, fresh and raw voices and dialogue and characters. I think about Raymond Carver's work, you know, really sort of like blue collar grit is one of the things I tend to associate. So those are the things that come to mind immediately. I don't know if you have other ideas about what you affiliate with Western literary.
Well, I think that it was certainly in your answer, this whole sense of space. It's just a different relationship to the space around you. And everything that you say is absolutely true about the concept of just sort of moving in and taking over and subduing the land without real mind toward consequences. But at the same time, there's just something fundamental about the sense of the space that is around you, which is totally different from, I mean, a mountain in the West means one thing, a mountain in the East means something entirely different.
Right.
It's just that sense of expanse that, especially if you come from that kind of territory, that it leaves a mark. It very definitely does.
Right. It makes me think of Joe Wilkins, and the way he talks about it is sort of our psychic landscape and our chosen landscape. You know, the landscapes that inhabit our deep psychic interiors, and then the ones we choose. I think about Jim Harrison, you know, the writers who've moved from Michigan, for instance, to Montana, and the way that they are able to talk about the land in those contrasting terms.
Are there any of the interviews that you have conducted that are especially memorable? And this could be good, memorable, or otherwise. And you don't have to name names.
You can euphemize
as you will.
Two of the most memorable actually relate to Canada. One of the things I've really tried to do is include Canada and to do some cross-border, you know, integration, because sometimes the arts in Canada and the arts in America don't talk to each other very well. So one of the interviews that I was most delighted to do was with Julianne Okot-Bitek, who's a Kenyan-born Ugandan who lives in Vancouver, Canada, and she wrote a book called 100 Days, and a book of poetry. And being able to talk with her over the phone just felt like I was reaching outside of the tiny mountain pocket that I live in and connecting across the world. And then I also had the extreme delight and pleasure of going to the CBC in Calgary and doing an interview about the oil patch up in Alberta. And that, again, was like, all right, this is where radio gets really interesting, is when we can really cross borders and talk about art and talk about issues of importance beyond our cute little studio walls.
Yes, that's marvelous. Terry Gross says that she has a nightmare about walking into an interview and having all these wonderful questions and asking these questions and only getting a yes or no answer from her guest. Have you had any nervous-making moments similar to that?
Oh, yeah. You know, I interviewed Jane Smiley, like the one and only Jane Smiley, and I was so nervous, and I think I gave her like the wrong directions to get into the studio, and somehow she waltzed in a baseball cap and a t-shirt and sat down and was so generous with herself and her time and so relaxed that it was able, you know, I had this like, I'm not worthy, imposter syndrome moment. And then really watching her move through that space and through that interview gave me a sense of like, oh, we're just two humans talking, and they're going to show up with whatever they have. And my job is to show up prepared and curious. And generally that, you know, sort of how I frame interviews, Jim, is like, I'm well prepared. I have lots of notes, and let's just have a good time. And generally, those guidelines work out. But yeah, when I interview like James Lee Burke and the real heavyweights, mm-hmm. I'm sweating.
Understood. Absolutely understood. Is there an interview that you can recall or a work of literature that you talked with the author about that moved you in some kind of really important and fundamental way?
Yeah. You know, the interview that we re-aired last week, Black Indian by Shonda Buchanan, that was a powerful moment for me because I was really unaware of triracial injustice in our country and the history of Indigenous and African American descendants here. And her presence was, again, so generous and open, but also so serious. And that's kind of where my skill set shines, is that I really can hang with intensity and with seriousness and also joyfulness around the fact that we get to talk about this now, the fact that there's airspace for these kinds of discussions and conversations is always very heartening. So I know it's a good interview if they cry, and I know it's a really good interview if I cry.
There you go. That kind of sums it all up now, doesn't it? That
yeah, exactly.
That it's amazing that this is a medium that can still reach out and very deeply and significantly touch people, and it's no visuals are necessary. That well, Sarah, I thank you so much for this chance to get to know you and to get to know your program a little bit better, called The Right Question. It's one of those wonderful titles. If you're unaware, it's WRITE, right? And just, it's a delight to be your office mate for that hour on Thursdays. Any books that you are really looking forward to pursuing in the next little while?
Yes. Yeah, I would just like to highlight, in a couple of weeks, we'll be airing Gary Ferguson and Dr. Maryam Clare, who work around the concept of full ecology and the 8 master lessons of nature. And it just is, it's a book for our times. So stay tuned for that.
That sounds excellent. Sarah Aronson, host of The Right Question, again, thank you so much, and greetings to everybody in Missoula.
Thank you so much, Jim. Same to you.
Sarah Aronson hosts The Right Question on KPBX Thursdays at 12:30 and on KSFC Sunday evenings at 6:30. Sarah is winner of the 2018 New American Poetry Prize for her debut collection And Other Bodiless Powers. Her works are also published in The Big Sky Journal, The High Desert Journal, Portland Review, Bellingham Review, and more. Music has the power to rouse or relax, ruffle or soothe. The power of music to calm is something we all need these days. So here's just a bit of peaceful sound from a 2019 concert by the Spokane String Quartet. Music of Joseph Haydn, played by the Spokane String Quartet here on Northwest Arts Review, which is available now as a podcast at SpokanePublicRadio.org or wherever podcasts lurk. We've been checking in periodically with Spokane Symphony Music Director James Lowe at his home outside Edinburgh, Scotland, as he deals with the realities of COVID-19 and its devastating effect on arts institutions, including very much the Spokane Symphony. Through it all, James remains hopeful and optimistic. From where you sit and from your experience, do you see anything as a silver lining to this whole situation that has been around us for quite a while and will obviously continue, and specifically in terms of awareness on part of the general public, kind of a raising of consciousness of people's knowledge that art music institutions like the symphony exist, and perhaps that their music is something that, oh, maybe I should listen to that. Do you have any sense of that happening?
I do. I think there is a silver lining. I am by nature an optimist, so I always try and find a silver lining to any situation. But I think there are a few things that are happening. I think that people have realized quite how much live music means to them. The not having it readily available. Most nights in Spokane, of course, there's something happening. You can go and see some live musical event. There being nothing, I think people have suddenly realized quite how much they miss that. I also think, certainly in the UK, the listenerships for classical radio have gone through the roof in the last couple of months, because people are trying to get away from, frankly, news stations are now so depressing, and they're trying to find something else. And I think a lot of people are dipping a toe into classical music now in this lockdown period, who kind of didn't really think about it so much. So I think there is a lot of positive things to come out. I also think the way all orchestras do business going forwards from this will be different. And I think there has been a trend over the last years to move away from the idea of a symphony orchestra as being just a machine that makes concerts, to being a community asset, to be something that gives and sits in the center of its community and has a lot of education outreach projects, as well as doing great concerts. That's something that is very interesting for me, and I think that's how orchestras are going to have to be when we come back from this. So I'm actually quite excited about what that world will look like and the role that the symphony orchestra can play within it.
I know that is our experience here. Our music and entertainment programming has been showing very strong listenership, and there is a need just to leave it all behind you and get your mind in a totally different place. And with you're saying that it's the job of orchestras these days and other ensembles and institutions like that to maybe shift gears a little bit and go in different directions. It was my pleasure to talk with Debbie Morris from the Education Committee of the Symphony the other day. And one thing that she mentioned, and I'd like you to enlarge on, is that there's a kind of a primary focus shift in terms of all of your educational outreach. Traditionally, this was where you reach the kids and you do concerts for fourth graders and all that, but you're thinking bigger now, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I've always felt that education doesn't stop when you're 18 years old. So why should our education department be primarily aimed at kids? That's not to say that the work we do with children and school age people is not good, or that we're going to stop doing that. I think we should do that. But as well, we need to broaden out, because music can be used as a tool for so much. It can improve so many things. You know, more and more I'm reading medical journals coming out with studies that have scientifically shown things that musicians have known for decades, which is that music can very, very strongly impact medical outcomes. So even like things like if you're recovering from a stroke or a heart attack, music therapy can actually play a huge role in speeding up your recovery. Now, musicians have known that music's good for your heart for hundreds of years, but it's nice now that the scientific community is getting in on that as well. So I'm really excited about how music can be used as a tool, how we can use our skills to connect with lots of different areas of life. So not just music appreciation, but using the power of music to nourish and change people's lives.
Are there some specific initiatives that you have in mind for helping to pursue that aim?
Well, one we have, which is now, unfortunately, thanks to COVID, on hold, but I think it will come back in some form, was the idea of a dementia project. For years, we've known that with people with severe dementia, music is kind of the last language that they lose. And suddenly, I'm sure if you go on YouTube and look for these things, you can find incredible videos of people who are totally locked in, who don't have any communication skills, but who hear a piece of music from their past, and suddenly they come alive again. And there's something really that lights up in them. So we were looking at designing a long-term music project, taking musicians in and working with dementia patients, also starting with a dementia-friendly concert. Now, of course, the idea of us going into dementia units right now, because of course some of these people are the highest risk for COVID-19, we have to rethink that. So maybe that's a project that we have to postpone a bit until things have changed with COVID, or maybe we're going to look at, or we are looking at, how we can move some of this activity online. And would that have the same effect, or does it have to be a one-to-one experience?
With the possibility that it will run a course, just what course that is remains to be seen. Do you have any at least tentative plans? I know that the reality of the situation right now is increasingly orchestras, opera companies, and the like are canceling parts of their season. So it's really difficult to be specific about this, but are there things that you and your colleagues have in mind as possibly getting before a live audience again?
Absolutely. So, yes, the Met Orchestra and New York Philharmonic have just announced they're doing nothing now until January. Nashville announced that they are doing nothing into July 2021. Our feeling is we are looking always on a daily basis at medical advice. We're reading a great deal of research that's coming out about how people can be safely on stage together. So we're looking at that, and we're putting together quite a large kind of contingency plan. Obviously, the safety of our players and the safety of our audience is the most important thing. But we're looking at what we could possibly do within those boundaries that is still live music, because I think it is so important for people that there is some artistic activity. How we do that, we're in the process of figuring out. I think we're hoping that we can announce something a little bit further down in the summer, some concrete plans. But yeah, we're very much trying to figure out how we can safely do live music and what format that will take.
And we certainly hope that the next time we chat, there may be some very definite plans coming to fruition. And definitely we look forward to that. James, thanks again for being with us today. As always, we look forward to your ultimate return to the U.S. here, and as well for continued welfare of everybody in your circle.
Thank you very much, Jim.
More on the Spokane Symphony is available at their website, spokanesymphony.org. The Painter and the Thief is an intriguing look at the nature of reality, says Dan Webster in this film review.
In an essay published last year on Forbes.com, the writer Cavell Litaru made an interesting, if somewhat obvious, argument. Cameras, he contended, don't capture reality. Rather, they offer only a version of it. The truth is that we don't witness events through photographs, he wrote. We witness one possible constructed reality of those events through the eyes of individuals telling stories and portraying their own narrative and interpretation of what they see. Litaro's proposition came to mind as I watched the documentary The Painter and the Thief, which is available through multiple streaming services. I watched it on Hulu. In only his second documentary feature, his first being Magnus, a 2016 film about a teen chess prodigy, Norwegian director Benjamin Rhee explores the relationship between two people who are just what his film's title makes clear: the Czech-born artist Barbora Kislykova and Carl Bertel Nordlund, a Norwegian guy whose struggles with heroin addiction have led him to commit crimes, such as robbery. Case in point, and the basis of Rhee's film, Bertel Nordlund served time in prison for stealing one of Kislykova's paintings. It was that specific robbery that attracted director Rhee, who for whatever reason had long been interested in making a film about art theft. He contacted Kislyakova, who had already decided not just to forgive Bertel Nordland, but to actually see if he would let her paint him. And so began Rhee's four-year-long process of filming what happened next. Incorporating footage shot by a friend of Kislyakova's, that of the artist approaching Bertel Nordland in court, Rhee picks up filming the two as they feel each other out, each of them, for personal reasons, having good reason not to trust easily. And he continues, exploring their individual lives as well, detailing Kislyakova's past relationship with an abusive partner and Bertel Nordland's tempestuous youth, pushing his ever-present camera at times so close to each of the film's principals that we can almost count the pores on her cheeks and the stubble comprising the individual hairs on the buzz-cut sides of his head. In the midst of all this character study, which includes Kislyakova's current relationship with her calm but sometimes confused new partner, Øystein, and a brief encounter with Bertel Nordland's father, Rhee explores the obvious mystery of what happened to the stolen paintings, only one of which Bertel Nordland took, the other being looted by his robbery cohort. This sequence in particular offers viewers a satisfying narrative payoff, as Kislyakova, having been told by Bertel Nordland that he was too high to have any actual memory of the crime, searches for and locates the other thief, and then follows his lead to an apartment complex where at least one of the paintings might be stashed. Yet to this sequence, as well as an especially moving moment when Kislyakova unveils the portrait she has painted of her new friend, an action that causes him to choke up with emotion, is so dramatically perfect that it's tempting to question just how honest a filmmaker Rhee truly is. That reaction, though, might be just a reflection of my own attitude toward the ground rules of so-called reality television that is itself, as is generally known, anything but real. Then again, what is reality? As the writer Litaru points out, aren't photographers, or more to the point here, filmmakers, by selectively picking time and place, angle, and framing device, choosing to tell the story they want, portraying a reality in the way they prefer, not in a way that someone with a more objective sensibility might pursue? What is real and what is fake is exactly the kind of ongoing argument that is at least part of why the United States is, at this moment, embroiled in such furor. In the case of the painter and the thief, though, my own resolution to that conundrum turns out to be simple. What, in the end, is the filmmaker's intent? And Rhee's intent seems as obvious as it turns out to be positive. By researching something that intrigued him, he stumbled onto a story far more interesting than a mere art heist. He discovered two damaged people, attached by a crime that affected both, finding in each other a way both to make amends and to face a better tomorrow. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm host and producer Jim Tevenin. My thanks today to Dan Webster, Sarah Aronson, James Lowe, and the Spokane String Quartet, who play us out with a bit more Beethoven. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.